We're having a moment. My name is Tracy Barlene, and I'm an alcoholic. So what happened is, not what Jason says, so I'm going to tell you the truth. Right. My sister was invited to speak here with my mom. And so Jason told me that he was very honored to step into some very big shoes, I understand. And he asked my mom and my sister to speak here. And so when he told me that, I immediately said, "Really? You asked Sheila and my mom, not me and my mom?" And he said, "Well, Sheila's her real daughter." And I said, "I'm her real daughter." He goes, "Well, you're coming in December." Okay. So my sister, about 5 weeks ago, I was her guest. I was to be her guest here. So I was coming. I was very honored that I was going to get to come. And about 5 weeks ago, my sister stood up and got her foot caught up in her headphone wires, and she fell, and she shattered her hip. And she had surgery, and she was very, very disappointed that she couldn't be here. So Jason called, and he said, "So, I heard you pushed your sister down the stairs so you could speak." I said, "Hey, girls got to do what girls got to do." So I am very honored to stand in her place. She's very sorry that she couldn't be here, but I think she's going to be at She Thang, which I love the name of that. That is awesome. So I'd like to do my my thank yous first, if you'll just indulge me. So I do feel honored, very honored, that I got to share this morning with you, Zan. What an honor. I've heard much about Harlan. I met him once. And for you to stand up here with grace and dignity and walk through what you've walked through, I've watched you throughout the weekend. It's amazing to see you, you know, just shine. And I feel honored. Thank you. Thank you very much to Don, who picked us up. And I believe that he left this morning to take Danny all the way into the airport, and he came all the way back out. I hope he's here, anyway. And he's taking us all back in one more time. So thank you, Don, for your service. And thank you, everyone, for your service. I've done conventions. I've done committees. I've started things. And it's a lot of work. And you get a lot of grief. Jason, you've done a great job. You really have done a great job. Thank you, Dana, for being my running buddy and my friend and just having my back. I love you. The speakers have just blown me away. They have been amazing. This is a really tough time in my life right now. It's probably one of the worst years I have ever had. And the speakers have just touched my heart, but sometimes there's some that will touch you more. And Joe, you just touched my heart. You shared some things that I needed to hear for what's going on in my life. And Tammy, I met his wife, and we're kindred spirits. You know, sometimes you get to travel around and you meet people, and, you know, it's a nice acquaintance, and it's nice to meet you, and, you know, I'll call you. And I'm really going to call Tammy. I'm really going to call. She's a lovely, beautiful woman, and I am so grateful I got to meet you guys. So it's Sunday morning. I hated Sunday mornings. Sundays were dark and lonely. The book talks about the alcoholic loneliness that only another alcoholic understands. And I know that you in this room understand the Sunday morning alcoholic loneliness, especially a woman of my type. So to stand in this room surrounded by beautiful people. And I am eyes bright, I'm sober. I woke up, well, I did wake up in a hotel, but I knew who I woke up with. For a girl like me, that is a spiritual experience in itself, right there. Enough said, sit down. Because when I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't look anybody in the eye. I looked at the floor. I was ashamed. I was dirty. I was guilty. And I felt humiliated and disgusted. And I never looked myself in the mirror anymore for what I had done, the actions I had taken, because I was a woman who needed to drink. And I was a woman who did whatever necessary to drink. And I know that there's plenty of you who know what that looks like. And when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, it was in a big convention, kind of like this. And I was walking down the aisle, and there was a woman, and I swear she floated. She just floated down that aisle. Her eyes were lit up and beautiful and appropriate clothes, and floated down the aisle. And I had gone to the bathroom, and I was coming back down that aisle, and I was looking at the floor, because I don't look you in the eye, especially a beautiful woman like that, because I don't deserve to have a woman like that look at me. And she caught my eye, and I don't know how, but she caught my eye, and she looked in my soul, eye to eye. And she said, "Hi, welcome." And that was all she said. And I felt clean for just a minute. I felt clean. So don't ever think that a small gesture like "hi" can't change someone's life. It changed my life, that one small "hi," soul to soul. So my badge says Phoenix, Arizona. My mom used to say, I'm currently sleeping in Phoenix, Arizona, but I'm from Texas. I am from Lubbock, Texas. And some of you may have heard, and I hope that you did. Those that didn't, I'm sorry that you didn't, because you missed a huge part of Alcoholics Anonymous is called family recovery. We get in here together, and we recover together. And the Al-Anon speaker yesterday afternoon, Vinoy, is actually my mom. So, my house was pretty lively. About 2 a.m, it usually came alive, and my little brother and I usually came alive about 2 a.m, and our house was awake. My mom would take us, and we would run, and we'd. Sometimes we go to a hotel, sometimes we go to a neighbor's house, sometimes we go to a friend's house, but we had to escape because my house was alive. My dad was a violent, crazy alcoholic, and I found out at a very early age that he actually wasn't my real father. My real father was in prison. He was a gangster, and he killed a man. And I wasn't to meet him until I was 18 years old. I've seen him about 3 times. He wants nothing to do with me. My last conversation was, "I don't even think you're my daughter." So I, you know, what I do with that is say, you know, too bad for you, because I'm kind of a good gal. and you're missing out on some great grandkids. So, you know, sorry for you. But my mom, eventually we escaped that alcoholic home, and I knew when I went to school every day that you knew what had happened in my house the night before. You knew that my house was crazy. I felt like a piece of crap. I felt embarrassed. I felt ashamed. And my mom took us out of that environment. She did not have an education. She did the best that she could, and she moved us out into the country. She had very little money, and we lived in a one-bedroom shack. The roof was coming in, the floors were falling through. My brother and I slept on bunk beds in the laundry room. And, the bus would come and pick us up, and one more time, I was ashamed. I felt guilty. I felt dirty. I was embarrassed. I liked to walk down the street before the bus came and picked us up so they didn't know where I lived. And I went to school every day like that, embarrassed and ashamed. And, you know, we didn't have the best of clothes. And one day, there was a boy named Jay. And Jay was the bad boy of the class. He had the long blonde hair. He had the big, thick black boots when he walked. And he had that wallet that had the chain. And he jingled when he walked. And he had a green GTO with big wide tires in the back, and we met eye to eye. And he asked me if I wanted to go. You want to go out? And my friend said, "Don't go, don't go, don't go. Bad reputation, bad guy. Don't go, don't go." So he picked me up. Picked me up that night, and in the seat. Was two brown paper bags, and one was for him and one was for me, and his had a six-pack of Bud, and mine had a bottle of Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill. Yes! And I'll just say that my life changed that night, more ways than one. What I found in that brown paper sack that night was a way to breathe. What I found was something that made my insides feel okay. It made it okay that, my dad was a drunk and that we were poor and lived in this shack and that my mom, was an uneducated, trying to help, raise two kids on her own. It took all of that away. And I fought for that feeling for many, many years. I wanted that feeling. It just made everything seem okay. Clancy talks about the disease of perception. And my perception changed. My house wasn't so bad. The shack became a mansion. It didn't matter. It just made everything seem okay. And I wanted that feeling over and over again at whatever cost. I was probably 12 or 13 years old. I'm not sure. I fought my mom. My mom and I went to war because I wanted to drink at any cost. I found the answer. I found the thing that made me be able to function in the world. I found it. And she was trying to stop me. And we went to war just like her and my dad. We went to war. It was 2:00 in the morning. The house was alive again. The fight was on. And I had to drink at any cost. My mom at this point had found this thing called Al-Anon, and I didn't know much about this thing, but it was somewhere that she went at night a lot. And they, back then, they had a theme of butterflies, and they would give butterfly pins. There's the story about the cocoon and the butterfly, and they would give butterfly pins to each other for their birthdays. And my mom liked that theme, and we had butterflies everywhere, everywhere. Every pillowcase, every picture, every towel. We had a set of orange pots and pans with butterflies around them. The only good thing about that is if you, I did do drugs, and if you did the drugs that I did and my friends did, you come to my house. It was a lot of fun to do the drugs that we did and watch butterflies all around the house. So that was the only fun thing about the butterflies. The other thing I learned about Al-Anon was my mom was on the phone a lot, and she said, "Oh, honey, it's just Tuesday." And I thought, wow, these people are stupid. They don't even know what day it is. My mom has to remind them the day. And that's all I knew about Al-Anon, except that we left this nightmare. Sometime around 16 or 17, I escaped, and my mom told me that I wasn't coming back, that I could just stay. Escaped, actually. And my friends and I got an apartment. I dropped out of high school. I went to work at a Pizza Hut, and one particular night we were at a bar, and it was Tom Collins nights. And if you know anything about Tom Collins, they're tall glasses with clear liquid, and they put a red cherry in it. And it was, I don't know, 10-cent night or something. And I had a whole lot of Tom Collins, and I had a whole lot of cherries. And sometime in the night, I was falling off that bar stool, and I was asked to leave. And I went out to the car that we had borrowed from the people across the hall of our apartments complex, and I apparently got sick and threw up all over the car and me, clear liquid and red cherries. So when I came to with red cherries stuck to my face, and it was probably 3 a.m. There was no one around. I was probably about 16 years old at the time. And when I came to, I was scared to death. And I had that feeling of, I just want to go home. I just want to be normal. I just want to have a white picket fence and the frilly curtains. I just want to be normal. I want to go to school and be part of the normal girls. I don't want to live like this. But I knew I had no choice to live like that. I knew that was my only choice because I had to drink. I had to have that feeling that it gave me. So when I came to, I didn't want to tell anybody all of that. I didn't want to tell you I was scared. I didn't want to tell you I wanted to go home. I went into the 7-Eleven. A guy got me a ride home. I banged on the door. My roommate opened the door, and she said, "My God, what is the matter? What happened?" And I had to come up with a story for why I was so hysterical. So I said, "I just got raped." And she was panicked. And I said, "There was two of them." And she's panicked. And I said, "One had a gun and one had a knife." And she is just beside herself. Now, I'm okay now because I'm in the house. And, you know, it made sense while I was all hysterical. She's flipping out. I just want to go to bed now because it's over. Not for her. I go to bed because I'm done. It's good. I'm done. And she starts getting on the phone, and she calls Bill and Bob and Joe and whoever. And somewhere in those phone calls, somebody called my mom, who I had not spoken to in months. And I open my eyes, and my bedroom door opens, and my mom walks in, and 5,000 Al-Anons behind her to help. And behind them was two police officers. And behind them was the forensic photographer who had to take the pictures. And behind them was the Rape Crisis Center representative who was assigned to my case. And I thought, I guess I'm going to have to go with this. So I went with it. I gave them a story. I gave them descriptions. I later found out that sometime during the night, one of the guys came out to check on me, and his fingerprints were on the car, and they lifted his prints, and they arrested him. And I had to go down and, you know, tell them that wasn't him. It was someone else. And the result of that is I did move home. You know, it was going to be different now. I'm going to go home. It's going to be better. I'm going to go back to school, and I'm going to get my life together, and I'm going to graduate. And I did do that. I did, you know, I did go home, and I did graduate. And now I'm decided I'm going to go to college, and I'm going to be, you know, I'm going to start over. I'm going to get it together, and I'm going to be a good girl. I'm going to go to college. So I swung by my probation officer's office first, because I had been arrested a few times for a few things. And I got my permission slip to go to another place to go to college. And I went off to college, and it's going to be different in college. And you know what happens in college. There's a lot of bars that do a lot of really cheap drinks for college kids. And I found my people. We always find our people. And I immediately was in the bars every night. And for some reason, wherever I go, there just seems to be problems. It just seems to be trouble everywhere I go. I am an out-there kind of girl. I am not a stay-at-home, have a drink. I am an out-there girl. It just followed me everywhere. We're at a bar. My best friend gets into a little scuffle that we help start, and just drunken, crazy girls, you know. And the end result of that fight is that girl got stabbed 3 times in the chest and was in the hospital for weeks. One more time, I'm in the middle of a mess, and shortly thereafter, we're at the same bar, same mess, same group of people, and this guy got in a fight with this guy, and there was baseball bats involved, and they beat this guy in the head with a baseball bat, and I had to go to court for that, and I just decided college probably wasn't the best place for me. So I decided that, I would start off on a new career, and I became a manager of a bar. Perfect. It was a perfect job for me, and I ran that bar for a while, until I realized I had the keys to the liquor, and I was asked to leave that job shortly thereafter. Sometime around 19, I'm not sure, 80 or so, my mom marries who I thought was the president of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know much except that he was in this big, big group in California called the Pacific Group, and he was some, I don't know, I just thought he was the president. He seemed to be a big deal. They moved to Oklahoma. They got married, moved to Oklahoma, and she came home one weekend for the Lubbock Convention. Hub of the Plains convention, which has been mentioned here. And she came home for that convention, and I always would go and see her at that convention just so I could see her. And for some reason, when I heard a speaker talk, it just put me in a good mood to hit the bar. So I don't know why. It's just kind of uplifting. So I would come to hear my mom and go to the bar. And that particular night, the first speaker was a woman named Alabama Carruthers, and she was funny, and I just loved her, and I thought, maybe I'll come back. And I came back the next night, and Johnny Harris, who someone had, one of the speakers talked about, Johnny Harris talked, and Johnny talked about if he only had frilly curtains, a white picket fence, everything would have been all right. And I thought, how did he know? And then Father Leo spoke, and he talked about the alcoholic loneliness that I mentioned earlier. And he talked about the hole in your gut that the wind whipped right through, and he never could get that hole filled up. And I understood what he was talking about. I knew that alcoholic loneliness. I knew that hole in my gut that the wind whipped through and that alcohol could not fill up anymore. I knew what he was talking about. And there was a man there named Albert Myers from Dallas, Texas. And they had, at that convention, they did the same thing they did here. They had new people stand up and they handed out big books. And I stood up that night and I took a big book. And Albert and I went outside in the lobby and we talked for hours. And he told me that there was a piece of velvet inside each one of us that God didn't let tarnish. Because I didn't think that I could ever get sober. I didn't think I could ever be around y'all. You were so clean and pretty and sober, and I just didn't think that I would ever fit in. I just didn't think that I could get this thing. It just seemed so far reached for me. I felt like I had gone way too far. Because a woman like me, you have to do what you have to do to drink. And sometimes that is losing your dignity and giving away your soul every time you take that drink, and every time you have to do what you have to do to get a drink, you just give a piece of your soul. And every time I knew that this is not the life that I wanted to live, I knew I didn't want that. I was raised Southern Baptist. I knew better, but I didn't know how not to. So I didn't think there was a chance that I could be around amongst you. And Albert told me about the little piece of velvet, and my mom, of course, was there that weekend and immediately went out and bought me a picture frame with a little piece of white velvet that I set right next to my bed. And Albert told me to leave that, you leave this convention and you go straight to a meeting. And I left that convention, I went straight to the meeting that night at the Hub of the Plains, and I got a sponsor right away. My mom sent me a box full of tapes. I was told some real simple things. You can't unplug, you can't pull out a tape and leave it empty. You got to plug in another one. I was a bar drinker. I was out every night. Music just put me in that mood. So I would take out a tape and I would put in an AA tape, and I got involved in Alcoholics Anonymous immediately. I found a young people's group. I got a sponsor right away. Now, there were three things that I was told to do. No major changes your first year, a meeting every day, and no relationships for your first year. Two out of three ain't bad. There he was. So AA boy met AA girl on campus, and I got pregnant, then we got married, and then we unmarried, and I ended up on Mom and Jim's porch in Dallas. So I moved to Dallas and was extremely active in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was told things like, why don't you, every meeting, because I didn't like the women. The women, I didn't relate to the women. The guys, no problem. And I was told, I want you to go to the meeting and I want you to find three women and I want you to listen to their share and I want you to, the next meeting, I want you to go back and ask them about whatever they shared. Well, that meant I had to actually listen to the women. That means I had to find out their names. That means I had to go talk to them. And I did that. I took actions like that to become a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was also told there was a particular night, we were having a big potluck, and I watched Maureen work at the potluck Thursday night, and she worked hard. Her and her husband worked so hard on that potluck. And it reminded me, when I was new, I felt so not a part of in this big meeting. And someone said, see that plate? It's empty. It needs some bread. Go in the kitchen, go get the bread, and put the bread on the plate. Why? Just do it. Just take the action. So I went in the kitchen, I got the bread, and I put it on the plate. And that became my plate, and that became my bread. And then someone else tried to put the bread on the plate, and I about knocked them over. That's my bread, that's my plate, that's mine, I got this. And I became a part of that, So if you're over in the corner and you don't feel a part of, get a job. I think Zan talked about that. Get a job in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you will become a part of. I took all those actions. I did those simple things that I was told to do. They wouldn't let me go home at night. I had to go to the girlfriend's house. We'd go play Uno till 1 in the morning, and then they would let me go. I was surrounded by a fantastic group of people trying to stay sober together. Eventually, I moved to Dallas. My mom and Jim moved back out to Los Angeles, and I had a little girl named Chardet, and we moved to California with them, and we went to L.A., and I became a member of the Pacific Group. I got a sponsor. I got active. I went to the yard. I worked on convention committees. I got to do this. I was a guest of many people, many conferences around, and I worked. I got a career in Alcoholics Anonymous. I became HR director in a law firm, and I worked in downtown Los Angeles on the 25th floor in a big law firm. I had the marble office. I had the window, the corner office with the window, the decorated office. I lived in Playa del Rey. I was three blocks from the beach. I had a little girl. I was sponsoring women, going to conferences, and life was, it looked really, really good on the outside. I had my mom and my sponsor and the girls threw me a big 10-year party. 10 years, 3 months and 3 days later, I went to South Dakota. I spoke at a convention. I came home on Sunday. I closed the blinds, locked the door, turned on the answering machine, and tried to commit suicide with 10 years and 3 months of sobriety. Sometime during the next day, my phone rang, and I guess I answered it, and whoever I talked to knew what had happened. I don't know if by my words or if I told them, I'm not sure how, but they knew what I had done. And one more time, the door opens to my apartment, and there's my mom. And behind her are the EMTs, and they locked me up is what they did. They put me on a lock hold. So I went to Daniel Freeman Psych Ward and was locked up. And, you know, I get asked all the time, what happened? You know, how did you lose? How did that happen? And I think Joe described it better, the best that I have ever heard. You know, you just... The truth is you stop doing AA, you stop doing the steps. I believe that every decision you make, you're either walking towards sobriety or you're walking away from sobriety. Every decision you make. And I started making little decisions, and I was walking away from sobriety and away from sobriety. I dropped this commitment. Took this inappropriate action, kept this from my sponsor, and the insides get a little tighter and a little tighter and a little tighter, and you get exactly what the book says, restless, irritable, and discontent. And I knew that it was either drink or commit suicide, because I had a reputation, like the book talked about, I had a reputation I knew I didn't deserve. I knew that behind the scenes, I was not living like a woman with 10 years of sobriety. And I knew that drinking, I knew that gig was up. I knew I couldn't live that life. I was at a grocery store, and there was a guy in front of me, and in the basket, there was two Hungry Man dinners and a bottle of Jack Daniels. And I thought, I can live that life. That's my life. When I drink, I cannot function. I don't work and drink. I don't have a daughter and drink. I had long since before this, I used to say lost custody of my daughter. The truth of the matter is I gave up my daughter. I signed over my daughter to her dad because I knew where I was going. I knew the path that I was going. I knew I wasn't going to stay sober. I knew it. It was my secret, and I didn't tell anybody. I went to that psych unit, and I was a member of the Pacific Group, and those people, they surrounded me. I had a girl called me, and, you know, they put you on Thorazine in those in there, and they waddled me down. The phone would ring, and they'd holler, "It's for her again," and they would waddle me down to the phone, and I would listen, and but I remember one girl said to me, "I would have missed my final exam." And I didn't quite know what she meant. And she said, "If you had died, I would have had to have been to your, I would have gone to your funeral, and I would have missed my exam for you." And it hit me at that very moment, that ripple effect, that everything we do affects more than just, it's not all about me. Every decision, everything I do has a ripple effect and affects people. Because we are in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I heard Dave Bray always talks about the zebra, that we run in a pack of zebras. And if you stay in the middle of the pack, the lions can't pick you off. And I have built my life to be in the middle of the zebras. I told that story a couple weeks ago at my home group. And some girl I've never seen her since, never seen her before, she came up to me right after the meeting and she said, "I'm not going to be one of your zebras." I said, "Okay." Understood. But I left that psych unit, and I went to a women's recovery house. And I couldn't stay sober. I couldn't stay. The shame, the embarrassment, the humiliation, it was all back, and I couldn't stay. And I was to leave that halfway house, and I was to be in and out of sobriety for the next 5 years. In and out, in and out, in and out. I'd get a little time, and I would leave. And I would sit in those rooms just like you are. I'd sit in a meeting, and I would say, I know that. I've already done that. I've already been there. I know. I'll never get that again. I know. I've already been there. And you know, those girls would walk by and say, keep coming back, and we're so glad you're here. And I would say, I taught you that. Get out of my face. I hated being back here. The excitement, the wonder. When I got sober the first time, I loved being sober. I loved being here. I felt clean and safe, and I was so happy to be out of that nightmare. And this time, it was different. This time, it was about hanging on and staying sober. And I hated it. I didn't think I would ever get the magic back. I didn't think I would ever get the excitement for Alcoholics Anonymous back. And I just tried to sit in my seat. And I just tried to sit in my seat. And I just couldn't stay. I just couldn't be here. The wonder was over. And I couldn't not drink. It was in 1998. And I was sober at the time, and we had gone back to Texas. We'd gone to my uncle's for Christmas, and my cousins were all there, and they were all going out to the bar. Now, my mom talked a little bit about a West Texas honky-tonk, and it's true that there's just magic it's just magic. And, my cousins were going out that night. They were going to the bar, and I knew there was a bar to the left, like Joe had talked about, exactly like he talked about. The bar was to the left. My cousins were going. I knew there was an AA meeting to the right. I knew there was a meeting that night, and I knew that's where I should go. I knew that was the path I needed to be on, and I couldn't not go. I had to go. I went to the bar with my cousins, and there he was. His name was Shane Henry. I mean, come on. Best pair of Wranglers I have ever seen. His belt buckle was the biggest in the room. 6'2", eyes of blue, the black hat. And he asked me to dance, and we danced all the way to Vegas and got married. I was living in Phoenix at the time, and we came back to Phoenix, and I called my mom, my poor mom. I called my mom one more time. I just got married, and she said, I didn't know you were dating. And I, the hardest call that I had to make was to my little daughter, and told my little daughter that I had just gotten married. And she was heartbroken. She was devastated that her mom had gotten married and she didn't get to go. She didn't get to be a part of her mom's marriage. And you never know how you hurt the people. We always think it's just, I'm not hurting anybody. I'm sitting in a hotel by myself. I'm not hurting anybody. You're hurting somebody, because we touch people's lives. People love us. And So Shane was on parole in Texas, so we had to quickly get back to Texas before we got caught. And Shane was a terrible, terrible drunk, and just gotten out of prison. And we set up housekeeping in Austin, Texas, and his aunt lived in a trailer park, and we set up a tent in front of the trailer. And I have to tell you that in Texas, it's very important that you are not trailer trash. I was not. Tent trash, I'm good. But you cannot be trailer trash in Texas. That's the lowest of the low, and I was not. So we set up housekeeping in our tent, and this new life together. And shortly thereafter, his aunt is alcoholic, obviously, and they had one of those big pools, those plastic pools full of water. And there was a drunken brawl one night and a fight, and someone ended up in that pool, and someone ended up cutting the pool, and the water, you know, went all over the yard, and our tent floated away with the pool, and my clothes floated away. And so eventually, you know, we did have to stay in the trailer for a short time until all the mud dried up and we could get a new tent for our housekeeping. And one particular night, Shane and I had, you know, we'd had another fight, and he had ran off. So my mom, hers is blondes, mine's redheads. Shane loved redheads for some reason, and he ran off with the redheaded stripper, and I was drunk and angry and had nothing to do that particular night, and I knew my mom and some of the girls that my sister sponsored. Sheila and I got sober right at the same time. She got sober in Oklahoma, and I got sober in Texas. Sheila was still sober, and some of her girls were going to Tyler, Texas for a convention, and my mom was speaking at that convention, and I was drunk and just didn't have anything to do, and I had the bright idea, I'll go to Tyler and see my mom at that convention. And I showed up in Tyler, Texas drunk. You know, my mom is, you know, behind the podium and telling her story, and she leans over that podium and starts to weep, and I'm in the back drunk, and I think, I wonder what story she's going to talk about. And she talked about the pain and the guilt and the shame that she felt because she had beat her daughter up, kicked her out on the streets, and her daughter was raped by two men. My mom carried that guilt and that shame for many years. And I could have come up to her after and told her the truth. I could have taken that from her, but I didn't. I didn't tell her. I got a drink is what I did, because you can't live with that guilt and shame on the inside. The book talks about restless, irritable, and discontent, and I had to drink. I came back, those girls from Oklahoma, they cleaned me up and gave me a shower and put me to bed, and I came back the next night, and there was a man named Vince Yeo was there at the meeting that night, and he yanked me up and took me in a corner, and he poked his finger in my face, and he said, I know you haven't asked me for my opinion. My stepdad, Jim Shaw, had died by that time, and he said, Jim would want me to do this, and I'm going to tell you how it is. And he said, Alcoholics Anonymous is for people who want to be sober. These people out here are trying to save their life. This is not a place for you to show up drunk because you have nothing else to do and humiliate your mother. Now, if you want to be sober, get in that chair, you earned it. If you don't, get out of here and go finish drinking. And I thought, up yours. Who are you? But I have to tell you, he was right. He was right. This room is sacred. This is sacred, hallowed ground. I love you guys. This is for people who want to save their life. This is people who are trying to live a different way. And I wasn't there for that. I was there because I was mad at the drunk. Vince handed me his card, and I put it in my back pocket, and I said, you betcha, pal. And I left and went back to Austin. And two nights later, Shane was off with the redhead again, and I was at the bar, and one of his friends was there, and I did the I'll show you, and James and I went off to finish our evening at his apartment, and he lived up on the third floor, and James and I, we bought bottles of Michelob in the bottle, and we're having a beer, you know, visiting, and the sliding glass door opens, and he forgot to tell me that he had a stripper girlfriend too, and that sliding glass door opened, and she stepped in, and she was not happy that I was there. She didn't want to join the party. She told me to get out, and James just said, I'm going to bed, and he went to bed, and she told me to get out, and I said, as soon as I finish my beer, I'll be gone. And so she took that beer and said, let me help you. And she poured it out, and I just went over to the fridge, and I got another one. And I sat down on the couch, and I said, I'll finish this one. I don't remember the next few minutes time. I don't remember what I was in and out. Apparently, this girl took that. I hit her in the head with that beer bottle, and she and James came out of the bedroom, and her and James literally just nearly beat me to death. I would come to, and he would be stomping my face, and I'd go back out, and I'd come to, and she would be kicking me in the gut, and I'd come back, I'd come to, and I was screaming and yelling, and I would come back, I'd come to for a minute, and the last time that I came to, I looked up, and she had his arms, and she was pulling him off of me, and she said, you got to stop, you're going to kill her. That woman saved my life. Seconds and inches is what Sharon talks about. Seconds and inches. One more kick, one more second, and I would not be behind this podium. That woman saved my life. I went to the hospital, went to emergency room, and they stitched me up and fixed me up and did all that they do there. And the nurse came into my room and she said, you're ready to go. We're going to release you now. And who do you want us to call to come pick you up? And I thought about it for a minute, and I had absolutely no one to come pick me up. I hadn't spoken to my family. I hadn't talked to my mom in months. I had no friends. My best friend was whoever was on the bar stool next and was buying. That's my best friend. Shane was off with the redhead. I had no one. And I said to the nurse, I don't have anyone to pick me up. And she said, oh, that's okay, honey. And I took that, because I knew the next words out of her mouth was going to make it all right. I knew she was going to fix it. I knew it was going to be okay. And what she said was, we'll call you a taxi and take you back to your tent. And I knew at that moment, the gig's up. It's over. And I knew at that moment, no human power can relieve my alcoholism. That is between me and God. And I had that moment. My husband says, before every spiritual awakening, there's a rude awakening. And I had that rude awakening that I was done and I was desperate and the fight was over. I couldn't fight it. I just couldn't do the fight one more day. And they did call me a taxi, and they did take me to my tent. And it just so happens that I had on the same jeans that I had on when I showed up at Tyler, Texas. Just so happens that I pulled out that card, and it was Vince Yo's card. And it was one more time, seconds and inches, because there was a beer, and there was a card. And I thought about my sister, Sheila, who was sober. She was at home with her husband and her kids, and she was safe, and she was warm in her bed that night. And I thought about Sheila and all those girls that had helped me so many times. And I called Vince. I picked up that 1,000-pound phone, and I called Vince, and I said, I'm done. I'm in pretty bad shape, and I need some help. And the Calvary was there immediately. He got on the phone, and there were people from Norman, Oklahoma, where my sister was sober. They were in Austin within 2 hours. They were there. And they scooped me up, and they took me to Norman, Oklahoma. And I did couch commitments. Those girls put me on their couches. My face was beat up. I could not work. My face was My eyes were swollen, and I couldn't work, and I had no money. And I showed up in Norman that morning with dried blood still in my hair. And my sister said, come to my shop. My sister worked in a salon with very beautiful women getting their hair done and their nails done. And I said, Sheila, I am not coming there. There's no way. And she said, you are my sister, and I love you, and you come here. And I went to that shop, and she cleaned my hair, and she took me to dinner. And I got immediately involved in Alcoholics Anonymous in Norman, Oklahoma, with those women. And one more time, the first weekend I was there, of course, they're busy, they're active, they're always going and doing, and we're going here, we're getting the car, and getting the car. And it was an anniversary in Dallas, and they were like, we're getting in the car, and we're going to this anniversary. And guess who the Al-Anon speaker was at this dang anniversary? My mom. And Polly Pistol. And we showed up at that, we showed up in Dallas, we were staying at somebody's house, and I was humiliated. I knew all those people at that event. I'd sponsored those girls at that event. And those women that came down from Norman with me, they just wanted to give me a little bit of dignity so I could walk in that room and face my mom one more time. And I had called my mom ahead of time and said, you know, I don't look so good, but I'll be there. And those girls went to Merrill Norman, and they bought purple cream and yellow cream, and they spent 2 hours on my face. Purple on the yellow, yellow on the purple. I had stitches across my face. They put glitter in my stitches. Because I'm a bling bling girl. And they proudly walked me into that room with just a little bit of dignity and a little bit of hope. And my mom and Polly were so gracious to me and made me feel like a woman with some dignity. No one in there shamed me. We don't shame our newcomers. We welcome them. We say, sit. Take a load off. Sit. I'll get you a cup of coffee. You don't need to get me one. I'll get you a cup of coffee. That's what they did for me. I went back to that group in Norman, Oklahoma. I got active. I got busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. Those women put me back together. A member of the group took my stitches out. And I tried to, after a little while, I could go back to work. And there was a member of that group that we lived in Norman. And I got a job in Oklahoma City. And I had no car. And I had to ride the bus. And this man, every morning, he, his wife, his daughter, they would come and pick me up. We would drop off his daughter at high school. We'd drive into Oklahoma City. He would drop me off. He would drop his wife off, and then he would go to work. And then he would do it every afternoon. He'd pick me up. We'd pick up his wife. We'd drive back to Norman, and he'd drop me off. He did that every day for a year until I could get a car. I owe. Anything you ask me to do, I owe. You betcha. How can I help you? What can I do for you? I will always say yes. I got sober and active in the group and got a little time under my belt. And I had this little girl that I had left. I had let her go. And I wanted a relationship back with my daughter. So I got the bright idea, you know, I'm going to go to court, I'm going to hire an attorney, I'm going to get her back, I'm going to be a mom, and I'm going to lose weight, and I'm going to go to school, I'm going to join the gym. And someone said to me, why don't you try to have the same address and phone number in your mom's phone for 1 year? Well, that's a goal. Never thought about that one. Why don't you start with making a commitment to call your daughter once a week? You don't have to tell her you're going to do that. You just do that. you call her every Sunday and just build that bridge. Start a relationship with your daughter and send the check. And I did that. I started calling my daughter once a week and building that relationship. I did not hire an attorney. My sponsor said, she's just fine where she is. She's doing just great. And you don't need to go in and stir up and tear up her life. She's doing just great. She graduated from high school, and I got her back. She came to live with me. Today is her birthday. She's 32. She got married. I bought a home. I moved to Phoenix, Arizona. I bought a home and got a life, got busy again, got busy in Alcoholics Anonymous, doing what I do. My daughter got married. She got sober. She married a guy in the program. She had a little boy. She had a little girl and her name Waverly Grace, and Waverly has a disability, and we just embraced that family. And Shardy came to me one day and said, "Mom, I don't think I'm alcoholic. I think I joined for him." Shortly thereafter, her and her husband divorced. My daughter met a hymn, and I started noticing things. I started noticing like scabs on her face, and I would say, "What's wrong with your face?" And she, "It's acne. I'm nervous. I'm worried." She got pregnant. She had a beautiful little boy, Forrest, my third grandson, and I would go pick him up and I would take him and spend time with him, and I'd have to hand him back to her. And when I would hand him back to her, I would notice the scabs on her arm, and I would have to hand that baby back to her every time. And I knew the path she was going. I knew where she was going. And in May of last year, I was on vacation in Iowa on a lake. One phone call can completely change your life. And the phone rang, and it was my sister. It was Sheila. Sheila's moved to Arizona with me. She's lived there with me for 4 years now. And she said, "Everybody's okay. But I got to tell you that Chardé's in the hospital, and Forrest, my one-year-old little grandson, is in the custody of DES. And I'm going to get to go get him." And I got on a plane. I said, "I'll be right there." And one more time, the ripple effect of alcoholism. We were at an event. There was a party. There were people. They had to turn around, take us back. I had to get a flight. I had to fly home. I flew home. My daughter tested positive for everything you can imagine. Her and her boyfriend had gotten into a horrible fight, and she was beat up, and I knew she was going down the same path as me. And I immediately went, "What did I do? What can I do to stop this?" Nothing. She's got to walk her path. I took custody of Forrest, and I've had Forrest for a year now. And on Wednesday, we go to court to find out if they're going to remove him from her permanently, or if she gets to have him back. In the meantime, she's had another baby. Last Saturday, we had to walk away from the hospital and leave that baby there, and DES took possession of that baby. I have no idea where she is. I have no idea who has her. But the good news is this. My daughter today is in a sober living for women. She checked in. a couple weeks ago. So there is hope. There is always hope. And she gets to see, she gets to see the baby, and you know, we have hope. We called her this morning, and she was doing pretty good. She seemed in good spirits, and you know, I know God's got a plan for her, and I'll just let Him do that. So I was sober and Alcoholics Anonymous. I was single in Phoenix. You know, just a big life. I have a big life, lots of friends, and set myself up to be, you know, single and a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went, it was kind of time. I was thinking, you know, I'm ready for a relationship. I'm ready to date. I think it's time. And I remembered a scenario with my daughter many years ago. She was a little tyke, and her favorite food was spaghetti. So I was cooking spaghetti, I was boiling the pasta, I was fixing the sauce, and I was getting the spaghetti ready, and she came into the kitchen, and she starts doing a jig, and I'm hungry, I want something now, and she reached in the cabinet, she got a bag of Doritos. And I said, no, do not eat those Doritos. I am fixing your spaghetti, your favorite meal, Sharday. Just give me a few more minutes and it'll be ready. And she took the Doritos off in the bedroom and she ate the Doritos. And I finished the spaghetti, and she had a little tight table, the little white table with the little green legs. And she had Barbie plates and a Barbie cup and a Barbie fork. And I got her spaghetti ready and I put it on her plate and I set it on the little table. And I went and got her and I set her in front of that spaghetti, and she pushed it away because she had gotten full on Doritos. And I saw that scene and it just clicked. That's what God is trying to tell you over and over and over. He's trying to get the perfect guy for you, but you keep getting full on Doritos. Leave the Doritos alone, girls. Wait for your spaghetti. It's coming. It's coming. My sponsor taught me a few things about dating, and she said to me, do not answer the door in your wedding dress. The date ends at the door. And when they say, do you want to come over and watch a movie? They don't want to watch a movie. I've since been told, I said that not too long ago, and in the line someone says, we don't do movies, we do flex and chill, right? So when they say you want to Netflix and chill, they don't want to do Netflix and chill. I learned how to be treated like a lady in these rooms by the other ladies in these rooms. You taught me how to dress appropriately, talk appropriately, have the language of a lady, dress like a lady, and you will attract a man who is respectful and will treat you like a lady. They will treat men and women, they will treat you the way you allow them to treat you. And those are some of the things my sponsor taught me. And I was at Beartooth Conference in Billings, Montana, 6 years ago. And I went there to see my sponsor. She is an active member in the recovery group. I think she's coming next year, I think. And I went to see her. And on Friday night, they asked me to read How It Works. And I walked across the stage in a cute little dress, a little skinnier, cute little dress, little halter dress. And I read How It Works. After the meeting, I was sitting with my sponsor, and this big, tall, big guy comes up, and he says, my name's John Barlene. It's awfully nice to meet you. In that really dark, deep, deep voice, and he always has a toothpick in his mouth. And he asked me, he said, you know, let's go to a meeting. And I went to a meeting. We spent the weekend getting to know each other, and you know, we didn't go off in the bushes, and not that time anyway. We acted appropriately because I am a lady, and I demanded that we act appropriately. And he courted me. John courted me, and he invited me to the Coast Range Conference, which was just down the road. And our first date was the Coast Range Conference. You know, we don't do a coffee date; we do a weekend date. Let's go. And at that weekend, we knew that we wanted to put something together, I told him, I said, you know, I've never had a wedding. I really, you know, my first time that I got married, I broke my family's heart, and I'm not gonna, I'm gonna have a big ass wedding. And my husband is bald, and he leans over and he rubs that bald head, and he said, "Define big ass." He learned. I defined. I had the wedding of my dreams. I had a beautiful wedding. Everyone was there. My mom got to be at my wedding. My daughter got to be a part of my wedding. And, you know, we've been on an amazing adventure for 6 years together. And in honor of Howard P., Howard Polentz, who just died on Saturday, last Saturday, Howard always says, "Go to the place where you find God, and go there often." And this is the place that I find God, and I will go here often. Thanks for having me.
But now, Now I'm found. Was blind, but now I see. Was grace that taught my heart to fear, and grace my fear relieved. How precious did that grace appear, the hour I first believed. Through many dangers, toils, and snares, I have already come. 'Twas grace that brought me safe thus far, and grace shall lead me home. When we've been there 10,000 years, bright shining as the sun, we've no less days sing God's praise than when we